Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Art Monthly Talk Show. My name is Alexandra Hull, and I'm very excited to be here on this rather chilly November evening. In tonight's episode, we'll be discussing three articles from our current issue of the Art Monthly magazine, our November issue. If you haven't had the opportunity to get yourself a copy of this month's issue, and hopefully our conversations tonight will encourage you to do so, you can purchase one through our website, www.artmonthly.co.uk. I'd like to welcome and thank all of my guests who are joining me this evening. We have George Vasey, a writer and curator at the Wellcome Collection in London. George will be discussing his profile of Imran Peretta, a London-based artist whose work explores ideas of biopower, marginality, and the deconstruction of cultural histories. Hi, George. We also have with us Elisabetta Fabrizi, a curator, art historian, and critic based in Newcastle in London. Elisabetta will be discussing her review of Experimenta, the artist film strand of BFI's London Film Festival that took place here in London in October. But first, we have Morgan Quaintance.
Oh, all right.
An artist and writer based in London, who'll be discussing his feature, The Politics of Appeasement, in which he anatomises the problems raised by Kara Walker's Tate Modern Commission. Morgan, yes. In your article, you explore how Kara Walker's work does nothing to highlight the myriad detrimental ideological and structural effects of the British Empire. Walker's work is just another depressing symptom of its endurance. And that's a quote from you yourself. Yeah. Maybe before we get into the discussion, could you maybe give us a bit of an introduction of Kara Walker's practice and how this new work relates to that, and maybe a description, well, definitely a description of the sculpture as well.
All right, so Kara Walker is an African-American artist. I don't know how long she's been operating for, but I think probably since the 90s. Her work, basically, I can describe it because it's always about the same subject, which is the antebellum era and slavery in the antebellum era. So what I mean by antebellum era, for anybody who's not familiar with that phrase, is before the war, but in relation to America, it's usually before the Civil War. And obviously before the abolition of slavery, slavery is very much in play. Now, Kara Walker cites her investigation of the antebellum era in the South. Yeah, so it's not in the North, it's in the South. And in the South, where do we see slavery taking place? Well, on the location, which is the plantation. And on the plantation, we have our familiar cast of characters, the overseer, the suppressed white wife, the abused black female subject, the black male subject, in various roles of abjection, subjection and degradation. So these people are always exhumed and brought forward and displayed again. This panoply of characters are always reused and recycled in her work. So the work is, I guess, best known in a way for the early kind of 90s paper silhouette videos, where she'd make these kind of videos using paper silhouettes of atrocities happening on the plantation, usually acts of violence visited by the overseer or his wife, his mistress, on the black slaves on the plantation. So another way of talking about it is plantation dramas, sort of body horror plantation dramas taking place in this kind of delicate paper animation. So latterly, though, her work has moved from that sphere into like painting and installation. So one of her most prominent installations was this 2014 sculpture called A Subtlety. And it was a large sugar, I think it was made of sugar, it was a large sculpture made of sugar in the shape of a sphinx, but that instead of like a normal like I think it's a lion, isn't it? I can't remember what sphinxes look like, but instead of the weird sphinx's head, it had the head of a mammy. So for people who don't know what a mammy is, this is Kara Walker moving slightly out of her comfort zone, which is antebellum era slavery and its kind of signs, symbols and signifiers. She was moving into a more kind of 19th century, early 20th century lexicon of racist imagery. And so she was using the image of the mammy. So the mammy is another character that sits in the kind of a racist pantheon of caricature or characters that are used in America in the 19th and the 20th century. So you've got the Mammy, who is a kind of large, oversized domestic worker who probably doubles as the surrogate mother to white families, also cooks and cleans, and is generally jovial, is as jovial as she is overweight, right? And has usually got like a cloth on her head. You've all probably seen her. Aunt Jemima is the kind of... is the go-to image for people who are trying to recall what that looks like. So alongside the Mammy, you've got the Buck, who is the big strapping male about town, the Coon, we've got the Coon, the Buck, the Mammy, and the tragic mulatto, who is this sort of liminal figure who is not black, not necessarily white, but sits tragically between two cultures and doesn't know where to site themselves. So this is like an introduction to Kara Walker's practice. So now you should understand roughly what she's about. And the new work called Fons Americanus, right, which is basically, I think, Latin for American fountain, is her new Tate Turbine Hall commission. So it sits in that big space when you walk into the Tate. And the work is, a response to or reimagining of the Victoria Monument, which is outside of Buckingham Palace, which is another fountain that, you know, nobody ever looks at because nobody ever looks at statues anymore. I don't know if they ever did. But basically, this monument has now been refigured or subverted in some way. So instead of like Queen Victoria regally atop the thing, you've got these various characters from, like I say, the antebellum era of slavery, or just the legacy of that period stretching up until like the, I guess, 19th century. So they're all kind of around this kind of cake-like cornice sculpture that sits in the Tate Auditorium. The idea is that this is supposed to equal some sort of critique of the empire. And maybe I'm just going to stop it there because I'm going to let you come in and interrogate me a bit rather than me just banging on. But now that's a good, I think, introduction to the point where we should continue from. Maybe.
No, that is definitely a great introduction. Thank you. Just to quickly go back, because you discuss it, you sort of mention in the article as well, talking about a subtlety, which is also subtitled as Marvelous Sugar Baby, an homage to the unpaid and overworked artisans who have refined our sweet taste from the cane fields to the kitchens of the New World on the occasion of the demolition of the Domino sugar refining plant. And that installation of this sort of sphinx-like mammy that you talk about is also responding directly to the place in which it is installed, right? Because it's a sugar factory.
Yeah, sure, whatever. These are sort of basic reaction to something. I mean, it's so unsophisticated and unsubtle and lacking in power that it's kind of banal to discuss. Yeah, sugar has a precedent in slavery. Yeah, water could relate to the transportation of slaves from Africa to the Americas across the Atlantic. Yeah, we know this, but that doesn't necessarily equal a devastating critique of slavery or the empire. And one of the things that you highlighted there was this, the kind of ornate mannered way she titles her works, which is to sort of bring forward this kind of a P.T. Barnum fairground attraction, 19th century freak show way of discussing her work. I don't know if you've ever seen, like, say, like the Elephant Man, or they used to have these things called mummy unravelings, where you go to like a kind of a public space and they'd unravel a mummy. But the spectacle itself would be introduced by this really ornate paragraph explaining what was going to happen and these miraculous sights. And she kind of borrows from that sort of practice. So I don't know. I think, to be honest, I'm sure I struggle to talk about her work because it's so banal. But yeah, it's framed as this kind of powerful intervention into celebratory discourses about empire, and also attempts to kind of gloss over the atrocities of the past. Now, why is it framed this way? Why is her work framed this way? Well, for me, it's quite clear that we're living through a period, I think, of history in the making. where I think this particular moment is going to have ramifications for the rest of the 21st century, basically. I've said it before, but the beginning of the 20th century, you had all the various avant-garde, you had Dada, Surrealism, all these other isms. They had their problems and their faults, but by and large, they were about scandalising the bourgeoisie, smashing tradition and going somewhere different, which eventually led us to where we are now. Now, at the moment, where are we? A rampantly commercialised sphere, marketised higher education, nobody can afford to make work, and what's happening? Institutions are engaged in the performance of political engagement. And the only way that they can carry out this performance by virtue signalling is to grab suitable moral agents. Now, the suitable moral agent is someone who's in a position to, I suppose, speak authoritatively about the conditions of some marginal subject position. So by virtue of Kara Walker's subject position as an African-American female, somehow that allows her to speak authoritatively about issues of subjection and degradation in relation to the black experience. But my issue is that her work doesn't go far enough. And that is precisely the reason why she is being used as a suitable moral agent. Because what institutions can do when they're performing political engagement is engage on the level of cosmetic difference, right? So rather than actually altering the structural things that are causing problems in the art world and the wider world at large, you kind of change the makeup, the physical makeup of these institutions, which almost sort of signals an alteration, but isn't really. So basically, another way of saying this is to say, the greatest threat to actual progression is the illusion that is already taking place. And her work in the Turbine Hall is an example of this mirage being cultivated and propagated. Progression is not taking place. Kara Walker's work isn't progressive. It does nothing to talk about empire. And it's just another way, I feel, for empire to endure.
Right. And on the Tate's website as well, sort of, if you're reading about the work, they sort of position it, because you talk as well in the article about how this, it sort of doesn't really try and comment on like contemporary issues around race and how that is experienced within Britain today. And I guess one of the sort of counter arguments to that would be that this argument around monuments and whether they belong in British society and...
Like who actually cares?
Yeah.
Who actually cares about a monument? You can take a monument down. It doesn't mean a thing. I've got time for people who are actually super upset about them. Yeah, I get it. You know, roads must fall, all the rest of it. But you take down the sculpture and nothing's going to change structurally. Yeah, you still have to engage with the institution, where the money's coming from, where it's going, who is hiding it, you know, like how police interact with you, how the medical services interact with you, how the legal system is set up, how that this society in England is stratified, right? All of those things are still in place, even though you've done this cosmetic alteration of the way things seem. Now, one of the key things that we have to talk about here is this like lack of understanding of how British society is functioning and the actual notion of empire. So these are direct quotes from Kara Walker, yeah? So this is what she said in the interview with The Guardian. From my perspective, the UK always seemed a fairly advanced place to be. To be black and British and get a good education and have a good vocabulary and not have this legacy of systemic violence and educational and economic oppression. Now, I'm sorry, but that's someone speaking from a position of complete ignorance. And I think this speaks to a sort of arrogance, a kind of US arrogance in relation to the rest of the world. And it does affect marginal subject positions as well, because it's almost as if saying, well, subjection only really exists in relation to the US, in the same way that innovation or artistic excellence only really exists in relation to the US. So I can comment on what's happening abroad without even really knowing what's going on. But just by virtue of me coming from this country that is the greatest and has also the most real experience of racial discrimination, possibly homophobia, possibly sexism. We could probably extend it out to all the biases that are kind of orienting society at the moment. Then they can speak from a position of authority in relation to what happens elsewhere. Or at least they can say, you know what, the stakes aren't as high here, so I can just, you know, roll out a gesture that's fairly clumsy and ill-informed, and it's not going to be that problematic. But the fact is, empire is still working in this country in ways that might be difficult for me to talk about at the moment because we're in an election and we've got to watch what we're saying on the radio. But yeah, maybe I'll just stop there and see if you've got any more questions.
No, yeah, and I'd just be interested to explore a bit further. You mentioned 12 Years a Slave, sort of Steve McQueen's body horror, which is also being classified as like torture porn because of the sort of gratuitous violence that exists with it, or like represented literally on the black body. And maybe just talk about that in relation.
So this is a precise example, right? The story of Solomon Northrup doesn't end in the South. In the film, the story of Solomon Northrup actually goes like this. He was a free man, he was abducted and put into slavery. He became free again, and then he tried to take his captors to court and failed and then disappeared. That is the story. You know, we all know what happens on the plantation. Mm. You can see it in slave exploitation film. Mm. You can see it in Django Unchained. We know what happens. Peoples are abused, raped, brutalized.
Yeah.
But that, you see, cites it in the South, which is the same problem that happens with Kara Walker's work. It historicizes this and it puts it at a distance. So we can safely condemn it and say we're all against it because, hey, it happened all the way that time ago and it happened there. But really, the failure of that film was to stop the narrative at the point where Solomon Northrup returned home and apologises to his family. It's almost like he's setting this up to say, you know, really the end point of this is to say, the end goal is just to have like a sort of heteronormative nuclear family where you're all getting along and this guy's just functioning in society. And actually, I think it would have been much more powerful to show the failure of the North and to show the failure of the juridical system that America was founded on. But that has to have ramifications for how things are working today. So I think, like, this is the failure of the film and the failure of Kara Walker's work, that she just is... It's like, I use the expression monomania. She's just like someone in a pub who just talks about the same thing. And you're just like, don't you have anything else to say? Don't you have anything else to say? but apparently not. And I think she's almost like an artist, like I say, who has play, because I think for institutions, she enables them to perform this political engagement, or enables them to have these quote unquote difficult conversations in spaces. But the fact is, who is going to see this work? Like, who is going to see this work and somehow learn a lesson, or somehow be comforted by a kind of a weak subversion of empire just through the register of like of the way things look? Tourists. That's like when I went to see this work, it was nothing but tourists videoing the work, looking at it. And so again, that speaks to this notion that somehow a work of art may what do they call it? Ronsier has that thing about the emancipated spectator. I can't remember. It's been ages since I've read him. But like, there was loads of discourse around Claire Bishop ages ago, people talking about how the spectator can be activated by work, right? Now, I've never, ever, ever seen a work that's made me want to be a fascist. Never. I've never seen a work that's made me say, I'm going to buy from Amazon. I've never seen a work that's made me say, do you know what? Capitalism is good. How do we then expect someone who doesn't feel that the empire was wrong, who thinks slavery is all right, and who thinks that racism doesn't exist, is going to look at Kara Walker's work and change their minds? Now, you may say that's not the case. That's not what people are saying is going to happen when you see this work. But what are they saying? What is it doing? And that's before we've even got to how much it costs.
Mm.
Now, I feel bad because, like, I should have really done a Freedom of Information request and found out so on the show I could tell you all, but I didn't have time. But, I may do one anyway, because this sort of monumental waste of resources and monumental waste of, like, space in order to have a kind of powerful gesture, I think needs to be addressed. And, I don't know. So I think having the real figure of what this thing cost out there would be worthwhile. So I might just do it.
But, I mean... Isn't that also a sort of a positive out of, you know, like a black female artist being presented in such a large institution?
That's a good, thank you for saying that, because that's one of them comebacks that somebody might have something to say. But okay, one of the things to say about that is, like, just how can I explain this quickly? I think rather than looking at this in terms of charity or gestures offered to somebody, you have to engage at the level of the work. Like, if you just then say, well, some marginal subject position should be gifted an opportunity and we should be grateful that this marginal subject position is represented within the institution, and therefore our normal critical registered, our normal critical faculties are sort of suspended to celebrate the fact that this person is included. What you're doing is two things, right? You're infantilizing the artist, and you're infantilizing the artist in particular and black people as a general populace. But you're also letting the institution off the hook. Let me just say this. You're not worthy of praise if your organization is racially, sexually, or in terms of gender, diverse. It's a basic thing. Yeah, it's a basic thing. Your organisation is not engaging with the contemporary if it isn't. That's like saying there's this sketch by a comedian called, I think it's Chris Rock, and he says, like, he hates dads he has this thing about, like, dads who are like, I take care of my kids. You know, that is not something to be proud of. That's what you're supposed to do. Mm. And the art world, just the fact that you're engaging, say, queer people or women or people of colour is nothing to be proud of. You're supposed to do it. Yeah. So this idea that, oh, because it's a black person, you know, we should be excited, that not only infantilizes the artist and the community and does a disservice to my own intelligence as a black person, but it also celebrates an institution that is not worthy of celebration. It's not worthy. Tate needs to go much, much further in order to garner my praise for doing something, you know. As long as it's an institution that, on the one hand, can show an exhibition like, I don't know, Soul of a Nation, which I thought was terrible. That exhibition was a joke. And at some point, I'm going to write about it. Because show the exhibition, Soul of a Nation, at the same time that just across the concourse, the Blavatnik building, yeah, is named after somebody who provided funding for the Trump administration. This is one of the most racist administrations America's ever had. So on the one hand, the institution's saying, check it out, we're doing this show about black radicality. And on the other hand, we're accepting money from somebody who's probably making it more difficult to be black in America, like for the longest while. So, you know, it's a much more complex situation. And I think you always have to be, like I say, diversity is not, it's like the basic, it's a basic situation. It's like saying, shouldn't this man be given props for not beating his partner? Like, you're not meant to beat your partner. You're meant to have a relationship where you're both together and you're both, there's equal respect, yeah? You have to look at the behaviour of the person. So I'm always suspicious when someone says, isn't it fantastic because this person, insert marginal subject position here, is in a position of power, whether it's a woman, a queer person, a transgender person, a person of colour. Just because they're that subject position doesn't automatically mean that they're going to be on your side. Let's just look at the Conservative government, sorry, or maybe the Labour government, or any other government, just look at any, like, sorry, I'm not sure if I'm gonna get in trouble for that, but like any other institution that's involved in the situation to do with the exercise of power over people. Generally, you can't just say because someone comes from some marginal subject position, they're going to have more vigilance or more understanding about certain conditions. And that's not to say that places shouldn't be diverse. Don't get it perverse. I'm just saying they should be that from the word go.
Thank you, Morgan. I think that's all we have time for now. But if we have a few minutes at the end, hopefully we can ask you some more questions. So, Elisabetta, on to you. We'll be talking about Experimenta, which is the artist moving image or artist film strand of the BFI Film Festival. Mm-hmm. Could you give us a little bit of an introduction to Experimenta and what you saw?
Yes, Experimenta, as you said, it's the strand, it's one of the many strands of the London Film Festival, and it's dedicated. Well, the definition has changed throughout the years, but at the moment it's dedicated to artist films, which is interesting in itself. So, you know, the debate used to be about experimental film. And so it's really interesting that now we sort of abandoned that category and we are onto the artist films kind of tag. And, you know, I declare my kind of interest here. I used to work for the BFI. I used to be the head of exhibitions and I used to curate the gallery there. So I have, of course, insight knowledge also of the festival. However, I haven't worked there for several years. So, you know, I felt I had enough distance to be critically engaged and objective. So I wanted to sort of clarify that. Mm-hmm. Experimenta has been, it has a long history. With different names, it existed in the 70s. You know, for many years, the London Filmmakers Co-op was responsible for it. For a couple of years, Film and Vid Umbrella curated it. So, you know, various colleagues have curated it throughout the years. And then since the beginning of the 2000s, it sort of became quite high profile under the curation of Mark Webber. And that's when I started experiencing Experimenta as a cinema goer. And it was quite different because at the time the debate was very much about form. So it was very much about experimental film and, you know, sort of the formal experimentation on a celluloid and so on. And it was a quite different affair. In the last few years, Helen DeWitt has been in charge. And Helen has been working for the BFI for many years for the London Film Festival. And prior to that, she was at the Lux Centre, so very experienced and very knowledgeable curator. And this year, the organisation opened it up and a team of three curators. Has put together the program. So there's Sarah Perks and Rabs Lanzicourt. And so the festival is a mixture of curated programs of short films and also premieres of feature-length films. And this year, it was, I felt, very, very interesting in the sense that there was a real sense of a real willingness to open up the discourse. You know, the BFI obviously, you know, linking to what Morgan just was talking about. And I know that Morgan also, you know the BFI as well, and of course it was really nice to see a real attempt at opening up the type of work that was allowed into Experimenta, of course I came to it with my own personal vision, and I was very interested in the amount of female voices that came through this festival. So, you know, a lot of women's stories in the actual films, and also women makers and women curators.
Mm. Yeah, you talk about, maybe you could expand a little bit on Nina Danino's I Die of Sadness, Crying for You, which sort of incorporates Coppola. And yeah, it would be great to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah, so Nina's film premiered at the festival, and it's an example of sort of feature-length film. I thought it was a successful film because it brings together, it's very personal, so it brings together very personal memories. So we see her mother singing Coppola songs. So Coppola is a sort of popular form, Spanish musical popular form derived from poetry, I understand. And so in the film, we see the director's mother singing these tunes that she would have sang while, you know, Nina was growing up. And then we see footage from television programs. And And then there's the voiceover of the director explaining a little bit about Coppola and pointing to something that records in the festival, and this idea of class, which I think comes out very strongly in many of the works. And this idea that, you know, there's a class at the end of the day is what kind of unites us, and all the sort of marginal positions perhaps need to kind of come together to make real change. It has to be a coming together. And this is one of the many films which looks at women who try to get out of the sort of marginal position, class marginal position that they found themselves in. And they did it through performance and sheer will.
Yeah, you open the review with a quote from Simone de Beauvoir. I think the essay is referenced in Nina DeNina's film. It's Brigitte Bardot and the Lolita syndrome. Could you maybe talk a little bit more about how that factored into the film and how that relates maybe to Coppola?
Yes, the director explains how the singers of Coppola were the precise opposite of Brigitte Bardot in the way that Bibi was described by de Beauvoir. And, you know, this idea that Bibi's face had no memories, no history, and so a man could project anything onto it. Opposite to this, the singers of Coppola proudly exhibited their difficult history, and that was their strength, and that was, you know, their emotions coming from the ordeal that they had to cope with in life. That was their beauty, and that was what allowed them to express themselves on stage in that way. So, you know, it's a celebration of women beyond the constructed womanly idea that society puts on us. And I feel that this is a theme that recurs in the festival in many different forms and shapes. And that's why I started the writing by mentioning this particular film.
You also talk about, it sounds like some of the most powerful works that come out are the result of collaborations. You reference Queering de Technologique and Krabby. Is it 2562? Is that film set in the future? Is that the...
Well, I mean, I'm mentioning Queering de Technologique because I felt that in that film, I mean, that is a short, I wouldn't call it a film, it's a short work, part of a curated program, Sarah Perks curated program. And the reason why I mention it here is that I felt that, again, a lot of the themes present in other works are brought together here quite beautifully. So it's an animation, it's a digital animation, and it has a metallic kind of computer-like voiceover, which describes the future. It's a voice from the future, tries to convince us in the present of the fact that a positive future is possible, and that the seeds are ready here for us to grow. And this voice, it's a voice that's both male and female. It's very difficult to sort of understand the position of this voice, and it's sort of is meant to symbolize a unity, opposition, a gathering together of forces, and which I was just referencing. You know, a future world in which different positions come together for a common fight, and I felt that, you know, it sort of brought a lot of things together quite nicely. I mean, overall, I just feel that This festival sort of links quite, I guess, if I can just mention something that Morgan was saying before. And in a way, I feel that one thing that perhaps is interesting is to think about the fact that an institution like the BFI, and we just mentioned the Tate, you know, there is a lot of engagement on the surface with important issues. And in my own research, I have asked myself the question of why there is so much moving image, for example, in institutions such as the Tate. And I often have wondered whether the fact that a lot of moving image engages with difficult subjects allows the institutions to perform, like Morgan was just saying, and whether engaging with this kind of material is also a way for institutions to sort of tick a box. So what I would say is that the BFI's or experimenters' involvement or engagement with these themes is very welcome. But I would agree with Morgan that, you know, that's just a given that needs to happen. Yeah. And then a lot of other things need to follow. Otherwise, what happens is that, you know, the moving image in this case and being my specialization, it sort of becomes a kind of fog that hides other, you know, again, I would go back to class and, you know, I don't know, workers' rights or rights of women that go on maternity leave and so on. So it's a fantastic step forward, I think. Mm. And then we shall be looking at what they will be doing in the future.
I think as well, in relation to, I guess, Morgan's criticism of Cara Walker's work, Zinzi Minot's film too deals with... It's work about the Windrush generation. Am I right? It's her second work to commemorate the Windrush Generation Day, and she sort of it's sort of a personal testimony where she includes archival images of her family.
That's right.
But yeah, maybe you could talk about that a little bit more.
Yes, I mean, I felt the work was it's very powerful, especially the use of sound. Mm. And of music in it, but I also found that her contribution during the Experimenta debate, this year Experimenta debate, was very powerful. And again, it was a very personal testimony. She talked about difficult situations that she has found herself in while performing due to her race. But also, again, I felt that it was really interesting when she opened up the discourse to, again, class, because she talked about the fact, something that, you know, also I find sort of familiar for my own situation, where she talked about her parents believing so hard that education was the answer to everything, that they believed that if, you know, their children went to uni, got a good degree, they would get a great job, and, you know, there would be no problem, no difference, you know, race-wise. And she talked about when, you know, her generation all went to uni, got first... very good degrees, and came back, and she said, no one got a job. And, you know, and that was the realization that actually things have to still have to change. And so she brought again the debate to issues that, you know, we can all, very many of us can relate to. And I felt that both her work and her contribution at the debate were very, very strong.
Mm. And just, we only have a few more minutes before I move on to George, but you talk as well about the impact of watching these kind of works in a cinema space and how that has on the representation of this work, because outside of, when it's not in a sort of a gallery setting, it doesn't allow sort of the curators or artists to maybe, I don't know, speculate or work on those ideas further. Could you maybe talk that about that a little bit, and how you talk about how it's both a sort of a limitation and an advantage? That would be great to just maybe finish off with that.
Yes, again, it's something that I've done a great deal of thinking about, because, you know, my research is kind of broadly about that. But I was reflecting on the change in time. So now that the moving image, or this kind of work, let's call it artist moving image work, is in the mainstream of the visual, of the contemporary art field, still in a tiny periphery of the cinema field. It's a very different scenario from when 10 years ago, let's say, you know, the BFI felt the need to open a gallery and engage with this material. This because the art world has expanded its activities with this field so much that, you know, the moving image is omnipresent everywhere. And as I said, you know, often sort of performance of political engagement, as Morgan said. And in a way, every festival, so what's happened is that every film festival has felt the need to have an expanded contemporary art kind of attachment to it. So Rotterdam does it, you know, they all do it. Berwick, you know, the AV Festival in Newcastle used to do it. So in a way, you go to a film festival and you feel like you're in a biennial. And so even though I recognize that for the London, for Experimenta to not allow that expanded mode, let's say, is a limitation because of what the field looks like now, I also felt that it was quite refreshing. I felt that by being in a cinema and looking at watching this material just as, you know, an attempt at still looking at this material as experimental film was quite refreshing because everybody else has kind of given up on that. But the contradiction here is the fact that a lot of the work that you see at Experimenta now has been created under the structural conditions of the contemporary art world. So, you know, the economic structure, the sort of interest around it, are those of the contemporary art world. So, you know, you are taking material that is created in the contemporary art world and you're showing it in a cinema. So it's kind of difficult to say that this material is cinema. So it's quite complex in that sense. But at the same time, I was given it the benefit of the doubt to some extent, and I do feel that this limitation, like often in life, limitations can also work positively, and that's how I looked at it.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Elisabetta. George, would you like to maybe give us a bit of an introduction to Imran Peretta and his work?
Yeah, I can do that. So Imran Peretta is an artist based in London who's half Bangladesh and half Italian. And his work, he works predominantly moving image and also sometimes sound. His work deals with the kind of testimony of growing up in a post 9/11 context with the war on terror and being of Bangladeshi heritage. So his films, his film practice has kind of been going for about 5-6 years now. So I guess he would be quite an emerging level as an artist. And his work deals with how black and brown people's bodies are made visible in very particular ways on very particular terms, but also people of colour are often silenced politically. So I guess a lot of his work is about, as I say in the profile, about returning a kind of subjectivity and interiority to his subjects.
In his earlier works, I think it's Desh and Brother to Brother, he uses his own body within the work, if I'm correct, and then in the later works he sort of chooses to not even use his own body, but I think it's actors, and then there's a sort of refusal of representation of the body, and that sort of you see that in what's the film that was at Jawood? Sorry,
15 days.
15 days. Yeah. That sort of kind of emerges as a the tent sort of acts as a proxy of the body. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, there's a few ideas in there, isn't there? I guess, as you say, in his earlier work, Dash and Brother to Brother, he's using his own body. I think as a sort of stand-in, as I say, I think it's important that he's talking from his own position, his own testimony. So Brother to Brother speaks about an experience where he's coming back, I think, from Pakistan, and he's stopped at the UK border and put into an interrogation room and asked questions because he's being racially profiled. In later works, I think 15 Days is really a key piece because, so with 15 Days, he went to the refugee camp in Dunkirk and made a series of visits and became friends with someone who was based at the camp who went by the alter ego 15 Days. Yeah. And he was called 15 Days, or he called himself 15 Days because that was the last time the French police had destroyed his belongings, had taken away everything from his campsite. And in the development of that work, Imran went back and made a series of interviews and got to know people on the camp and asked them about their experiences, and then worked to develop or co-write the script. So he's sort of speaking with his subjects, and as you say, that we don't see 15 Days. The tent acts as a kind of proxy for his body. And we don't know much about 15 Days other than the sort of film starts with an Arabic prayer. Mm. And then 15 Days talks about the kind of labor of waiting. The film is really about a space of being trapped at the border and kind of structural violence, both at a personal level and a kind of state level. Mm. So I think, as I was saying, it's about sort of speaking with a subject to give 15 Days a kind of, for him to tell his own story.
Mm. And in 15 Days, there's sort of the tent scene, which sort of structures the sort of front part of the video. It kind of is almost stage-like, and then there's the sort of background filming that's sort of a handheld camera with sort of text overlaid, and there's quite there's sort of a dissonance between the temporalities, the way the tent is it sort of breathes and it's slow, and then the background feels much more agitated. Could you maybe talk about that a little bit more, and maybe how that comes out in
I was trying to think of the word. So basically it's a form of animation where he took photographs at the site with 15 Days, and then they transferred the photograph into a 3D animation. I've got no idea what that process is called. so what you're seeing on screen, and this is a kind of recurrent motif within Imran's work, is this kind of relationship between a kind of animated space. And I guess he's trying to shift... How do you create an iconography of migration, right? And the camp. It's very, very difficult. And that's juxtaposed with this handheld footage in the background. So often within Imran's work, you see these shifts from kind of drone footage to handheld footage to kind of animated forms of representation. So I guess they speak to different forms of power relationships and how they're enacted through the gaze or different forms of gazes. Often also in Brother to Brother, he's sort of sitting against a green screen. So he's very interested in how the body is often, you can enact a form of violence through the crop. So it's a close crop on the body. Often the head is physically kind of cropped out of the image. And as you say, he layers these kind of other forms of visualities over the top.
Yeah, which kind of links to there's sort of an interest of sort of representing something that's uncanny or dreamlike. And you talk as well about in the piece about smoke and water and how that references sort of brings to mind sort of images of acts of trauma. But I was listening to an interview with him, and he was also talking about he's very influenced by or interested in magical realist literature.
Yeah.
Could you maybe talk about that a little bit more? And
yeah, there's sort of CGI elements within all of the films, and smoke and water appears in a lot of the films. In the film that's on at Spike Island at the moment, The Destructors, I can talk a little bit about that film, but smoke again appears in that film. So there's four young men of Muslim heritage, that again have been developed through a series of workshops in East London, working with young men of Muslim heritage, that they're situated in this community centre. And the script talks about lots of things, but one of the things that stood out to me is when it talks about the welfare state becoming a kind of warfare state. Mm. So the war on terror, the kind of war on poor people, the war on marginalised communities is a kind of constant state of duress. So the smoke, I guess, can mean lots of different things, but I kind of read it like the aftermath of an explosion. I was thinking of horror films, yeah. You know, the kind of idea of the ominous fog.
Yeah, again, in this interview that I was listening to, he talks about the problem of representing trauma and kind of not wanting to represent the body because of the problems around that, and how he can do it in the most sort of sensitive and anonymous way, I guess, and not to contribute to this bank of images that we already have that are like accelerated in the media.
I think it's that thing about how, if you think of surveillance as a type of invisibility that constantly looks, it's the privilege of power. Somebody that can kind of control a subject through that invisibility. And I think the way that Imran uses invisibility is a way to think about obfuscation, or almost a right to be invisible, but also to shift a kind of representation of a body almost as a kind of object to the script, which enables somebody to speak from their own experience. And I think that's the key thing, that he's trying to, in a way, personalise forms of structural violence, contemporary forms of structural violence that are kind of embedded within everything from online algorithms to border control to every form of, like, camera that, you know, that's what he's talking about, I think.
Yeah, it'd be great to hear a bit more about the show at Spike Island. Is it it's the film on its own, or is it?
Yeah, so it's a new commission, and I probably got all the names of who's commissioned it wrong. So it's produced, it's commissioned, co-commissioned by Chisenhale, Spike Island, Whitworth and Baltic. And I'm probably missing someone out there. But so it's touring around the UK, and I think this is every 2 years they have a similar kind of commissioning mechanism. And it's the sort of the film The Destructors, which is a two-channel film. And it's influenced by a short story by Graham Greene, written in the post-war period, that Imran read as a teenager, about a group of young men that go into a house and sort of destroy it. So he's interested in, when he read it, and sort of thinking about that time where he felt that his body, just being a person of colour and being adolescent in London at that point, where he was felt to be a criminal or criminalised because of who he was. So The Destructors is these four men talking about their experiences, as I was saying, that the kind of idea of the welfare state being a form of kind of warfare, and I guess this intersects with other forms of marginalisation and atomisation. And for me, like, the community centre becomes another type of protagonist in the film.
Right.
It's completely dilapidated, you know, and elements with the smoke coming in, and the kind of, there's it springs a leak, so water starts to rise through the doors. And again, I think Imran has an incredible way of using sound in his work in a very affective way.
That was something I wanted to ask you about, because he's part of a collaborative project, AMRA, right, with Paul Purgas. And I know that he made the soundtrack for this film and for 15 Days. So it'll the sound within 15 Days is very powerful. It'll be great to hear a little bit more about that. You kind of talk about this percussiveness of the soundtrack.
Yeah, at Spike Island, the sound is sort of surround sound. So there's elements where the building starts to take on a kind of character. So you hear behind you a door slamming shut, but you're not actually seeing it on screen. So I think sound becomes another kind of way of telling the story. And I think that he often talks about the music kind of building suspense, that the sort of feeling of something that's ominous, that you never get a kind of release from. His films tend to jump around. They're both percussive and kind of episodic, so there's no kind of linear narrative. But yeah, I think that sound, it's about creating a further form of embodiment.
Yeah.
The sound of the camera and the cameraman's breathing, his breathing is often within the soundtrack. So I guess he's trying to render the apparatus of filmmaking a bit more opaque to make us more aware of the kind of construction of the image. Mm.
Okay. I think we have a few minutes left. Does anyone have any questions or for other speakers or points to make?
I think Elizabeth's point about class is a good one. And it's, not a good one, but it's really important. Because I think, I was thinking about this earlier today, that, England's a tiny country. So Britain is a tiny, tiny, tiny island. But we're so separated. And this isn't just another evocation of what's happening post the EU referendum. But it is to say that, you know, if you think about it, like how many different people from different parts of the country do you meet in London? Like I rarely meet people from Newcastle or Liverpool or Manchester, and they're really, really, really close by. I mean, if you're thinking about America, it's a huge country, right? Mm. So I just think there are so many things that link different experiences in the UK, particularly experiences of subjection in relation to the state, and it's usually across the vector of class. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't get so much of a look in, and I think the reason why is because most of the people given a platform are bourgeois or middle class, even people of colour who are given a platform. So I reckon if you did a survey, quite a lot of people are privately educated. Mm. You know, and so that's no disrespect to you being from that subject position, whatever. Mm-hmm. But it is to say that sometimes that class vector doesn't experience how things cut across racial and ethnic divides, because once you get down to the sort of lower end, there's much more intermixing, there's much more sort of cross-cultural production. So I think class is very, very important. Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. And, you know, in recent years I've kind of developed an interest for Pierre Bourdieu. And, you know...
Pierre Bourdieu, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I've got a friend. Yeah. I've made friends with Bourdieu.
Yeah,
we're just going to have a chat. Yeah. But, you know, like, again, I mean, he's my sort of guiding light at the moment. Yeah. And, you know, I kind of see... Obviously, he famously looked at the field of cultural production in France in the 60s, end of the 50s. And, you know... looking at the field that I work in, you know, as a curator and that I know very well, I kind of see a lot of the same class reproduction at work here. You know, like things haven't really changed very much. And just to link again to Morgan before, when he was talking about Gara Walker's work and, you know, who's going to see this work. And that's a really big thing because, you know, when you apply that to the moving image, again, who's going to see a work, let's say, you know, like an artist that I'm sure we all love in this room, John Okonfor, of course, you know, I adore his work. But, you know, if you place that really powerful work on television, a lot of people are going to see it, and that's going to cut through class. Mm. But now, obviously, you know, John has an amazing career in the art world, which we're all happy about. But who's seeing that work now? And we need to ask ourselves that question. And, you know, I ask that question to myself as a curator. You know, what kind of contribution have I given by bringing John's work into the gallery? Hopefully positive, but is that enough? You know, or should we fight to get that work on TV again? You know, that sort of kind of... doubts, you know, filtered by Bourdieu, are filtering like through my mind.
Can I just get one quick point? Just one quick point. No. All right.
Sorry, Morgan.
Later.
Thank you, everyone, for joining me. Morgan Quaintance, thanks. Elizabeth Fabrizi, and George Vasey.
Thank you.
This has been the Art Monthly Talk Show.
Thank you.